Let me just tell you a little background about this being the 16th Big Book Seminar held right here every year. Every time we've had one, this is the 16th one, and all of them have been held at Palm Air. They're very cooperative. As a matter of fact, I have to come out here and tell them what to do because I have more experience than any of those folks do. They seem to last about a year or so here, but they've always been cooperative. They look at their file and said, "Oh, you've been here 11 years. You're a good client. We want you here every time." So they work with us and they provide for us and take good care of us, and they're glad to see us every year. And for the most part, I'm sure that, and I don't know this for certain, but in the hotel industry, we make a pretty good client. We tend to be responsible and reasonable and not too rowdy. We don't tear up too much. And we're easy to get along with. So I'm sure that's one of another reason they're glad to see us. Let's see if I have any other announcements. But in the beginning, when Wesley started this, after running into Charlie and Joe in the late 70s, there's no doubt in my mind, began to formulate and had a vision of this very setting. I'm sure he saw that. The reason I know that he saw that because this is the result. This is what it is. This is the reality right now. But Wesley ran into these guys, and up until he put this seminar together, and the first one was held in May of 1983, 11 years ago. Until that time, we know we have conventions, we have roundups, we have retreats, we have all sorts of things going on. But up until that time, nobody had really given the time necessary to go through the process called recovery from the Big Book, because it takes a little time to do that. And usually on a program, a couple hours or 3 hours or 4 hour workshop would be about max. And so Wesley took the risk. And Charlie and Joe will talk a little bit about this when they come on this afternoon. But he took the risk to put this together. And of course, I was one of his little babies, one of his pigeons. And when he showed me the working schedule for this thing, I looked at it and I asked the same questions that Stuart did. What about the dance? And what about the golf tournament and all that? When are we going to do this, that, and the other? And Wesley said, "No, we're going to be here strictly for business." But I said, "Wesley, it won't work. You see, I'm coming from my little limited experience of going to conventions and those kinds of things, and nobody, we just heard somebody talk for an hour, and when we'd get up and convince about how much he lied there about everything and how much he did or didn't know and critique his talk, and then we'd go on about our business." So when I looked at the schedule and I saw, and in the beginning we went till 10 or 10:30 in the evening. I mean, it was a long process from my point of view. I said, "Wesley, this thing ain't going to work. It just will not work. Alcoholics ain't going to sit for that amount of time." He says, "Well, I believe they will if we give them something to chew on." And that was some of his terminology. That's the way Wesley talked. But I said, "Well, I just don't believe it's going to work. I think we need to consider a dance and a golf tournament." And then he said the magic words that got my attention. He says, "John, I want you to be part of this program." I said, "You know, Wesley, I believe this thing is going to be just fine." He won me over right then and there. And I said, "Well, yeah, what do you want me to do?" He said, "Well, I think you ought to do the history of the book in the beginning and set it up." And so we've been doing that, and I think what Stuart had to say about that makes an awful lot of sense. I always thought that they had history in schools as a means of punishing students. That was my conception of it. But the reality is that if you know something about the past and how we got here, we can appreciate this moment. And we all have our own history. As a matter of fact, for the most part, it has all been, it was necessary for us to be here today, all of our histories. And so it is with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a fascinating story. And I don't even know where the beginning is, but the game plan for this particular session is to let me do just a little bit of introduction, and then Frank is going to talk about the evolution of alcoholism in this country beginning in the colonial days right up until the time AA come into being. And then I'm going to tell a little bit about the Big Book, how it was written. That's the thing that we're going to be basically studying, and it's an interesting story too. And all we can do really is surface it. So I want to suggest that you know that The history of our book is written in AA Comes of Age, written by the guy who had a lot to do with it, Bill W., and those first 100 folks. That's in AA Comes of Age. And then we have some other information available in terms of our the evolution of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA Comes of Age, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, Lois Remembers. All those things are wonderful pieces of information, so that the more you get about that, the more I think that you develop an absolute passion and love for Alcoholics Anonymous. It becomes so much more meaningful. Because sometimes a lot of us come into AA and we sort of feel like, and I've heard Frank say this, you come into an outfit that you think's been here all the time. It's like IBM or Chrysler or General Motors, and you know, you're just a small little gnat part of it. But yet you don't know how significant you and I are as individuals in Alcoholics Anonymous until we grab that history. And when we see that history, we see how close we came at times not even to be here. And how fortunate that you and I are today as we stand on the shoulders of those who preceded us. People like Wesley and those who preceded him. People who loved us enough to do whatever was necessary for us to get here. So we like to talk about that a little bit. And I want to use a couple of visuals. I like to use visuals because they are a step above listening. And I usually start this way and ask you the question, how many squares do you see here? 16 or 70. Most folks say that. At first glance, 16, that's what I said the first time. And then about half a minute later, I saw the one on the outside, and I said, well, there's 17 of them there. And then somebody said, well, let's take another look at it. And as we do look at it, we see that there's the 16, and then there's 17 and 18. And if we look a little closer, we see 19, 20, 21, and 22. And then if you configure it the other way, then you've got 23 through 26. Configure it another way, you got 27 and 28, and so on and so forth. Till when you really look at it, there's 30 squares there. Now, what's the significance of that? The significance is this. There's sometimes more to something than meets the eye. You know? At a glance, you saw 16 or 17. But there were more than that. And another thing that it points out is that sometimes we need somebody to point these things out to us. Sometimes the obvious is not so obvious. And also, I want to put up on the screen sort of an analogy of one of the reasons that we're dedicated to doing what we do here on an annual basis is to get focused and get centered on the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's written in the big book, because this is the way it was in the beginning. And if you use the analogy that it was that way and it was like a Christmas tree in the beginning when we had the big book and the first 100 and the 12 steps, and that's what everybody focused on in 1939. And then since that time, and what's happened since that time is not about right or wrong, it's just about maybe some distractions or some things that have happened. And you know what we do with Christmas trees, we put ornaments on them and, you know, decorate them up. And so we'll start decorating this tree with some of the things that we've come up with from the beginning. And I don't pull them out in any necessary order. And I probably don't have all of them, but I just give you an idea of some stuff. Of course, we now have medallions that we like to use to signify certain periods of sobriety. There's nothing wrong with that. And we spend some time in meetings on medallions and chips and so on and so forth. And I wonder why this one came up real fast. There's a seminar. We have seminars now which I don't think are a bad deal. So see, it's not about right or wrong. It's just about some of the things we do that decorate the tree. Here's one that says, well, we have institution meetings. Nothing wrong with that. We've got to have institution meetings because we got a lot of us in there. And, of course, we've developed some retreats. We need to go out and get spiritual once a year or so. And so we have retreats. We now have, you know, we have the young people's meetings, and then we have the women's only meetings. And, of course, we have these cakes now that we get fat and celebrate on. Oh, we have conventions. Nothing wrong with that. We do have conventions. We had our first big one in 1950. Then we have picnics. Nothing wrong with picnics, but we have those. Oh, we have roundups. We got to have some roundups every now and then, and I'm not talking about the cowboy type. And we have men's meetings. They're there. Then we have just get-togethers. You know, nothing wrong with a get-together. And then we have the I'm Different meetings. Well, let's focus on what makes us different, you know. We have public meetings. They're good so that the public becomes informed. We have speaker discussion meetings, a lot of those going on, right? Nothing wrong with that. Then the meetings where you go in and they open the meeting up, and then the chairman says, anybody got a problem? There's a got a problem meeting. And, of course, all sorts of discussion meetings. We have the CHIPS. You know, the CHIPS have come about since we had our... Nothing wrong with that, just ways to acknowledge. We have tradition meetings. Not enough of them, but we have them. Then we have open meetings. We have closed meetings. Then we have speaker meetings. They're good. Speaker meetings, there's nothing wrong with that. We have anonymous meetings. These are the folks who just have meetings and they don't let anybody know about it. Nothing wrong with that. Airline pilots, attorneys, judges, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of them use the anonymous meetings as a springboard to get into AA. Nothing wrong with them. That's what they do, though. Step meetings, we have a few of those. Closed meetings, I think you're getting the picture now. We have dinner meetings. Business meetings. Oh, we shouldn't have business meetings, but we do. No, I'm just kidding. Business meetings. We have gay meetings, of course. We have... can you top this meetings? So that what you have an awful lot of ornaments, but what has happened? We've covered up the basic 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with all these things. And here again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with any of that. That's just the way it is. There's nothing wrong with it. I think that's just the way we are. We would have created it if it didn't have it yet. We'd still proceed on and create it. You know, so that's just the way we are. But sometimes I think it's important for me to understand and know that it's easy to get distracted in Alcoholics Anonymous and get unfocused and stay off. You know, you can go to meetings and never hear anything about recovery sometimes today. So that's the whole point of it. Not right or wrong, but I think sometimes we might lose our way if we're not focused and directed on this thing. So that's the purpose. That's the Christmas tree to sort of point up that we sometimes... need to just remember that Alcoholics Anonymous in its origin was 12 steps in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only reason we ever got together in the beginning was to discuss how that book worked. That's all. And then we have evolved and have a whole lot of other things now. And I like this statement that comes out of our book, one of our pamphlets. It's called Problems Other Than Alcohol. Which it says, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teachings and practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of an AA group. That's the only reason that AA groups meet. That's what I get out of it. So I guess it would be important for me to take a quick inventory of my meeting, my home group, and I'd ask myself, is that what we're doing? Are we teaching and practicing the 12 steps of recovery? And if we're not, then I'd say, well, I'd maybe better take another look at this thing. And Margaret Mead said this, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world, and indeed the only thing that ever has. And I go back to Wesley's premise that this thing would work, even though we had a lot of naysayers, myself including initially. Oh no, we've never done that before. I don't think it's going to work. But Wesley saw it. He indeed saw it. And he stuck to it. No matter what I said or what Stuart said, he went right ahead with it. So that the reason that we're here this weekend basically is to be together in the understanding of this thing and to know that we're here for that reason only. We're here for some serious business. Our lives are literally on the line. Alcoholics who have that fatal malady die if they go back to it. So I want to do everything that I can not to go back to it. If it includes understanding and knowing of our history, then that's what I want to know. And Frank's going to say this again. I got it from him, but Carl Sandburg said that the study of any society or civilization that had come on the scene and had disappeared, all of those civilizations or societies had one thing in common, and that is they had forgotten from whence they came. So we don't ever forget from whence we come. But, of course, we've got to know from whence we come, don't we? So that's the purpose of the first session. And at this time, Frank is going to discuss some of the things that have occurred in the last, since colonial times, with respect to treating alcoholism. He's going to mention some folks, and at the same time, you don't have this in your packet, but I'm going to put it up on the screen. Perhaps you can follow. And in the back, if you just know that what Frank will be talking about, it would be here if you can't see this. And he's just going to tell you about the evolution of alcoholism up until the time the big book was written. And at that time, I'm going to tell you a little story about how the big book was written. And then after that, we have some slides here. Some slides of perhaps some of the pictures we have on the walls, but then some that we don't have, that Frank is going to go through these and explain the picture. So, Frank, I want to introduce now to you the guy who takes care of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous at this time, who works in our General Service Office. That's what he does. It's not important to him being here, but I want to introduce him and let you know that's what he does, and I want you to say hello to Frank M. from New York.
Thanks, everybody. My name's Frank. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
And I'm really happy to be in your company. And I've been coming down for a number of years, and so I've had the advantage of knowing a lot of you and feeling reaffirmed every time I come. And I need it. You know, I can forget a lot of stuff. And when we get this kind of concentration of power and focus, it penetrates all of my crap, all my racket, all my stuff. And by Sunday, I'm going, you know, how did I ever lose my way? Somebody said neurotics run faster when they lost their way. And that's the way I am, you know. If I'm driving and I don't know where I'm going faster. You know, I can't stop to ask for directions. You just drive faster. And my life is like that. And this stops me. This kind of critical mass of people intensely, as John said, addressing the basic principles without all the stuff on the tree realigns me and puts me where I'm supposed to be. You're a good-looking crowd, I'll say that, from up here. You know, the kind of people I would have liked to have had a drink or two with each of you, you know, before I started all this kind of relax. And someone came up to me, a friend of mine came up and said, for God's sake, smile. You know, you look like you're going to a hanging. You know, and I don't know where all that intensity comes, but when it's my turn to participate, when John says, "You're on, Frank," I'm really very serious about it. And a woman once sensed that with me in, I think it was Tucson, and just before I was about to speak, she left a little card in front of me, and it said "The Secret." And the secret had 4 points to it. The first point was, begin where you are. And I couldn't get out of there, so I had to stay there. I'd begin where I am. And the second was, do what you can gracefully. She underscored gracefully because I guess she saw some of my spastic approach to life before where I'd upset my papers that I'm going to refer to. And the third was step out in faith. And the fourth, which I always forget until I'm centered like this, is expect God to help. You know, because none of us could do this unless we were guided in some funny way, even against all our objections. And I'm sure you had thousands of objections for why not to be here. And yet somehow the fact that you're here prevailed. And that's what we serve when we come here. That little margin that prevails over all of our stuff to bring us another way. And that's the distinctiveness about Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow for almost 59 years, we'll be 59 years next month, we'll be 59 years, somehow we've prevailed. Alcoholics have tried to get sober before. and they failed. We've all know people in our own group. I mean, learned, wonderful, gifted, sensitive, warm, and loving people that have been unable to get or sustain sobriety. You know, that's the mystery we live in. You know, and that's the mystery we serve. And we do it the best by getting together and getting centered ourselves so we can be the most, as John said and Stu reaffirmed, to be the best sponsors or the best critical mass of Alcoholics Anonymous we can be that any other person, alcoholic, will ever meet in that moment, in that day. You know, be the most informed, be the most accepting and tolerant and loving person we can be in that moment. And I think these kinds of seminars really help me to get clear on that. I don't have to be good, I just have to be willing and of service to God. And that's the thing. Joe put me on to the fact that alcoholics have been around for a long time. You know, we're not the first on the planet to make a mess. Alcoholics have been making a mess before. Those of you who have been to seminars before know that Joe reads this from, this is 800 to 1,000 years before Christ. This is Solomon describing, I think, progressive alcoholism. He starts off by saying, "Who?" And this is in Proverbs 23:29. "Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling?" See if you identify with any of these things. "Who hath wounds without cause?" You know, black and blue on a Monday morning and wonder, "Oh, what happened to me?" "Who hath redness of eyes?" "They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine. Look not upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth its color in the cup on Friday night, you know, after work when you're going out, you're all dressed up. You know, don't look at it at that point. When it moveth itself aright, at last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or he that lieth upon the top of a mast, weaving, careening all over town," that kind of stuff. "They have stricken me, thou shalt say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again." You know, the mystery. All broken and wounded, and what is the first thing we ask for? "I need a drink." They will seek it yet again. The mystery of alcoholism. Why are we so self-destructive? You know. 2,000 years ago, a man, almost 3,000 years ago, a man witnessed that and baffled by that, that behavior. I often wonder, all through history, people have been watching us and wondering, why do they do that? And I'm always amused they ask the alcoholic the question, you know, why do you do that? You know, why were you driving up the exit to the freeway, you know? Like, we know these answers, you know, and we try to please them. We try to come up with, you know, logical answers coming out of a blackout. You know, we try to be as creative as we can, you know. "Well, my friend went up that way," you know, or that blame it on others is a favorite. You know, things that don't have answers when you're drunk. And we have a whole life of that kind of living before we get here. And I think A is about furnishing some of the answers to our questions. And alcoholics every once in a while throughout history have found answers, partial answers, sometimes seemingly almost a whole complete answer, and they lost it again. You know, because in addition to us having an answer, we have to have other people, I think, to reinforce us when we forget the answer. You know what seminars do, what your group does. You know, after you're all riddled with being eaten alive all during the week, when you go to your meeting, and finally you understand again, and you're refreshed and renewed. You know, that's what alcoholics need. So we need a method, which we have, the 12 steps, but we also need a community. an environment with which to apply the things that we know. An Alcoholics Anonymous is about a method. We have a proven method. I don't think we have to bear witness the fact that you know, there are 2 million recovered alcoholics in the world now in 145 countries. The method works. Our problem now is to establish, are we going to be around for another 59 years? You know. And I know it would be spiritually arrogant for me to believe that because I've been sober many years now, and I'm grateful for that, that I'll always be sober unless I'm careful. You know, I have to be careful. My alcoholism, whether I like it or not, is fragile. My sobriety is fragile. I might think I'm invincible. I might get distracted and not worry about it a lot or not even think about it a lot. But the reality of it is I'm not far away from a fresh disaster. I witness that all the time in my comings and goings in alcoholics. We all know people sober 37 years, 27 years, 7 years, whatever, and have lost their way again. And I learn by those people. You know. And what brings it right up to me is consciousness. I have to live in a state of consciousness. And these seminars bring us immediately to a state of consciousness of understanding, I believe, and gratitude. You know, that somehow we've made it against all possible odds. We're recovered alcoholics this moment in Pompano Beach, Florida. And statistically, I don't know what we have, 450 people. To get 400 recovered alcoholics against all possible individual odds collected in one place at one time is almost statistically impossible. And yet we're here. We're demonstration that this thing can work, that the method can work. Now we have to demonstrate is if we can get along together and not fragment, as John has described, or whatever, and not be around to support and sustain each other. And as John and Stu indicated, history is important. I have to own my own history or I'm going to be in trouble. I have to remember what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I have to do that on a regular basis. If I don't do it, the first thing I lose is my gratitude. You know, I want more of whatever it is. You know, from stop being a grateful person, I become a demanding person. You know, I want a new car, I want a bigger house, I want more whatever, more trips or whatever. I get distracted into a material world and forget the fact that I'm living by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as expressed in that thing, a very happy life today. And collectively, we can lose this thing too. AA cannot take all kinds of abuse and still prevail. I mean, that's what I think history has when you look at it. As I said, almost 3,000 years ago, people knew about progressiveness in alcohol, and nothing really came to my knowledge yet. Some of you might have more information. Nothing really came as kind of a method for dealing with that until maybe in my experience anyway in this country. Benjamin Rush came. I'm going to try to follow that if I can, because I tend to wander and not get back to the printed. But some of you may remember, and I hope you forget. My history is not good on following patterns. But Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, the first physician in this country to be appointed as the main physician, the main surgeon for the Continental Army. Was a very prominent man. And in 1785, he wrote a paper entitled The Inquiry into the Effects of Ardent Spirits Upon the Human Body of Mind and Mind. And I'm just going to read you little excerpts from this, and you're welcome to come and look at these after. He gets into the part one by saying, the effects of ardent spirits divide themselves into such which are of a prompt and such which are of a chronic nature. The former discover themselves in drunkenness, and the latter in a numerous train of diseases and vices of the body and mind. He termed alcoholism a disease in 1785. And here we're still having that argument today. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, as you know, doesn't have an opinion on that. We call it in our big book a malady and illness, so we don't want to get into all this controversy. I'm just saying society collectively can have agreement on what a thing is and then lose it again. You know? So anyway, in 1785, this prominent man, and he goes on to say, this odious disease, for that is by the name that it should be called, appears more or less with the following symptoms. See if any of you recall these symptoms. The most commonly in the order in which I shall enumerate them. Unusual garrulity. Talk too much. Any of you talk too much? Unusual silence. Capriciousness and a disposition to quarrel. Uncommon good humor and an insipid simpering or laugh. Profane swearing and cursing. Disclosure of their own or other people's secrets. Certain to get you into trouble. A rude disposition to tell those persons in company whom they know they're false. Certain immodest actions. I'm sorry to say that this sign is the first sign of drunkenness. Sometimes appears in women who, when sober, are uniformly remarkable for chaste and decent manners. A clipping of words is 9. Fighting, a black eye, or swelled nose often mark this grade of drunkenness. Here, 11. Extravagant acts, which indicate a temporary fit of madness. These are singing, hallooing, roaring, imitating the noises of brute animals, jumping, tearing off clothes, dancing naked, breaking glasses and china, dashing other articles of household furniture upon the ground or floor. After a while, this paroxysm of drunkenness is completely formed. The face now becomes flushed, the eyes project, and are somewhat watery. Winking is less frequent than is natural. The underlip is protruded, the head inclines a little to one shoulder, the jaw falls, belchings and hiccupings take place. The limbs totter, the whole body staggers. The unfortunate subject of this history next falls on his seat. He looks around him with vacant countenance and mutters inarticulate sounds to himself. He attempts to rise and walk. In this attempt, he falls on his side, from which he gradually turns upon his back. He now closes his eyes and falls into profound sleep, frequently attended with snoring and profuse sweats, and sometimes with such a relaxation of the muscles which confine the bladder and the lower bowels as to produce a symptom which delicacy forbids me to mention. In this condition, he often lies for 10, 12, 24 hours, or 2, 3, 4, 5 days, an object of pity and disgust to his friends and family. His recovery from this fit of intoxication is marked with several peculiar appearances. He opens his eyes and closes them again. He gapes and stretches his limbs. He coughs and then pukes. His voice is hoarse. He rises with difficulty. Does that sound like the morning to any of us? He staggers to his chair. His eyes resemble balls of fire. His hands tremble. He loathes the sight of food. He calls for a glass of spirits to compose his stomach. Get me a drink. He now and then emits a deep-fed sigh or groan or a transient twing of conscience, and then more frequently scolds, curses everything around him. In this state of languor and stupidity remains for 2 or 3 days before he is able to resume his former habits of business and conversation. The man knew about alcoholism. He goes on to list the chronic conditions, all of which we know: decay of the appetite, jaundice, dropsy, hoarseness, diabetes, redness, eruptions in all parts of the body, rum buds, fetid breath, frequent disgusting belchings, epilepsy, madness, and gout. The progression of alcoholism. You know, that's incredible. He knew that over 200 years ago. And yet when I walked into Intergroup in June of 1970 and they told me it was the first drink, I went, wow. Never occurred to me that it was progressive. I knew it wasn't getting any better, but it never occurred to me that people who lived in on the Bowery didn't grow up there. You know, that, I didn't know that they were just like me 10 minutes ago. You know, I knew that, I guess I had a vague idea that alcoholism was a disease. I thought it was like psoriasis. You know, you had a mild, moderate, severe case. I had a mild to moderate case. with occasional eruptions, eruptions were arrests for drunken driving, being asked to resign your job and clean out your desk, you know, that kind of stuff. Those were eruptions. I thought it never occurred to me that you went from mild, moderate to severe in the same hour, frequently in a few minutes. And yet all of us know from our history that that's exactly true, that you can be homicidal and suicidal in a matter of minutes if you were to start drinking again. That's the reality of alcoholism. Alcoholism isn't drinking when you want to drink. Everybody drinks when they want to drink. Alcoholism is when you know all this stuff. You've had decades of living like this, and yet you get another drink and another drink and another one. When everyone is screaming at you these facts about you, and you get another drink, and you run away. You get the car keys and you run away. And that's the kind of thing that's baffling and the kind of thing that we can celebrate that we have today, that we don't have to live like that anymore. And we can carry this happy news to others that are today living like that, who don't know the way in the summer of 1970. I didn't know. Anyway, that was what happened. The Emmanuel movements came along in the turn of the century. I better stick to my... Am I skipping ahead here? Yeah. Well, then we go to the temperance... I'm reminded, we had the temperance movement, which, is about 1820. The country has always had serious problems with alcoholism. Some people said the pilgrims got off at Plymouth Rock not because they wanted to live in Massachusetts, but because they ran out of booze. And I identify with that. I went a lot of places I didn't intend to, because we had run out of booze. And if you've ever read statistics or seen statistics on the consumption of alcohol at colonial times, it makes us look like pikers. Enormous volumes of course, they only lived to 35, most of them in those days. And they were little people. So if you've ever seen a colonial bed, your dog wouldn't fit in it. So they had vast quantities per cellular thing of alcohol, and had lots of problems. This country is founded on problems, so it's not a surprise we're having problems today. Anyway, the temperance movement came, and this paper I read, some of the excerpts from the paper, Benjamin Rush, became the basic text of the temperance cause. It was a very popular paper and distributed widely. At one time in this country with the temperance, 25% of the adult population over 15 signed a temperance pledge. So temperance swept this country at one point, because people saw what alcoholism did. Just before 1840, a group was to start, which is mentioned in the book that John mentioned, Our History, AA Comes of Age. Where it has some of these facts, a group called the Washingtonians, which were an outgrowth of the temperance cause. These were alcoholics. They met at Chase Tavern in Baltimore. Six alcoholics were drunk every night at the tavern, and one of them had heard of a faint little rumbling of a temperance thing, and they said, well, you go down and you go to the meeting and come back and report to us what it's about. The next night he did that, and by God, the six of them got sober. Talk about spontaneous combustion. That whole group got sober, and they got sober in March of 1840. By Christmas of 1840, there were 1,000 people, recovered sots, they call them in those days, in the Washingtonians. You remember from our own history that it took 4.5 years for us to get 100 people. They got 1,000 in less than a year. Their second anniversary, Abraham Lincoln spoke to them. Their high water mark was, depending on what newspaper you read, 500 to 600,000 recovered sots in the Washingtonians. The population of the country was 20 million. AA would have to have 10 million in the United States today to have the same ratio. Who ever heard of the Washingtonians today except people who read AA Comes of Age or people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I often muse, whatever happened to the 500,000, 600,000 recovered sots, because in 12 years it was written about them, they had lost their thunder. What they did was, as John talked about, they got distracted. You know, they didn't fail because they weren't big enough. They probably failed because they were too big and too successful. And they didn't have grounding roots in basic principles that they were able to adhere to. And so, like a summer storm, they were just swept away because they didn't have principles that they'd adhere to. We're very gifted. We have 12 principles in our steps, and we have 12 principles in our traditions. And the key is to be conscious of those and apply those in all our affairs, not to be distracted. Well, in 12 years, the Washingtonians were gone, and nothing really happened until the turn of this century, when the Emanuel movement came along. This was the time of William James and the time of Mary Baker Eddy, and people were becoming very conscious that if you took the power of religion and the power of science, the power of psychology, and put those together, you would have an incredible symbiotic method for dealing with all kinds of functional disorders. Usually science fights with religion. There's big quarrels. You know, it's like in ourselves. Our scientific mind quarrels with our spiritual mind often. Left hemisphere, right hemisphere. Well, we want to be spiritual, but we don't want to give up the bank account. You know, not today anyway. You know, that kind of stuff. We want to make a nice contribution to our group, but maybe a dollar will be all right. You know, that kind of tension we all live in. And we live in that as a society. You know, there are those people who rabidly believe in science, are rationalists, and there are those who believe God is everything, that reason is Satan and something. And somehow you have to get some kind of symbiotic relationship between those two forces to really be effective and useful. And that's what the Emanuel groups tried to do. There was a man who founded it, Worcester. He was a minister, Episcopal minister, and he studied psychology in Europe. This was the time of the beginnings of the background for Freud, for Jung, for Adler. People were becoming alive to the fact that there are psychological principles that, when applied to people, work. And he attempted to bring those into a religious thinking, a religious community, and it worked. Many, many alcoholics got sober. They first started to treat all functional nervous disorders. But they soon found out that many, many nervous disorders were alcoholics. And they began to become very, very effective in dealing with alcoholics. People from all over the country they started in Boston. They went to the Emanuel Church. And they had a whole clinic aside. You'd be examined by a physician. And then you'd be turned over to a minister if you had no functional disorders. You'd be turned over to a minister to give you some kind of religious guidance in your life. They even had a recovered alcoholic who became probably the first paid counselor. He got sober, and they found out that he was very effective in bringing the message to other alcoholics, and they hired him as a full-time employee. And he got a man sober. One of his people who got sober was a man who was then to write Richard Peabody a book called The Common Sense of Drinking. It was published in 1932, and it was a bestseller. It wasn't too religious, but it had a lot of relaxation techniques and affirmations and things that could help an alcoholic to get sober. And it was a big seller in its day, and it influenced Bill Wilson. It's in Bill's library. And so you can see all these kinds of things. They all had an ingredient coming together into the collective consciousness of people. Our ancestor was the Oxford groups. Both Bill and Bob got independently sober in the Oxford groups. First Bill, and John will get into a little more history, and so will Joe and Charlie, how the message was carried to Bill by an old friend of his, Ebby. But Ebbie somehow had gotten involved, and you'll hear it, with the Oxford groups. And the Oxford groups were very powerful. They're immediate ancestors. Bill in the AA Comes of Age says, all our spiritual principles come from the Oxford groups, and all of those were sent by way of Sam Shoemaker. You know, so all the steps and the thinking behind the steps, the reconciliation, the amends, taking of inventory, all of those serving God, all of those vital principles came directly from the Oxford groups. At one time, the Oxford groups had lots of house parties. Bill Wilson went to Oxford group meetings up at Stockbridge. There were 6,000 people at these meetings. You know, so, like our roundups and our international convention. They had a convention in 1937, I believe, at the Hollywood Bowl. 27,000 people inside the Hollywood Bowl and another 10,000 outside the Hollywood Bowl. This was a thing started by Frank Bookman, a Lutheran minister, in 1920, and it took off like a fire. And at one time, 40% of the people studying in a very prominent religious college were people whose lives had been influenced by Frank Bookman. And he initially had lots of principles. He did not want his name used. He did not want to call Bookmanism. He came up with a name, a long story, but he came up with the name the Oxford Groups because they were very successful with students at Oxford University. And anyway, at one time, almost every major politician in this country attended Oxford Group meetings. Harry Truman, names probably a lot of you younger people wouldn't know. Fiorello LaGuardia, who read the funny papers to me when I was a kid on the radio. All of these people attended Oxford Group meetings. You were a member of the Oxford Groups if you said you were. It was non-denominational. It had a lot of the qualities, I won't go into them, that we had. But they basically had one person helping another and getting rid of the things that block you from experience the power of God in your life. And that's exactly what the steps are about. Getting rid of the distractions in your life so you can sense fully, completely, and effectively the power of God in your life. I drank for power. I felt empowered when I drank. And that's what I need in my recovery. I need access to power. Some kind of God-given direction in my life so I feel whole and complete and useful, and I'm not just being battered around by life and chewed up. And that's why we come here, I think, basically. And that was the search of the Oxford groups. But they, too, got distracted from their basic principles, like the Christmas tree. They got involved in politics. Frank Bookman, people said, you're very effective helping alcoholics. And he said, I love alcoholics, but I have drunken nations on my hands. You know, he saw the world getting ready for war. And he felt if he could approach the world leaders, he could avert the carnage of World War II. And so turning away from the fact that the true revolutions happen in the soul of each individual, that's the true revolution. If this country is to undergo a revolution in a positive way, it's going to happen in your soul and mine. It's not going to happen out there by building a new building, by doing something outside. It's going to happen within our hearts and within our souls. And Frank Bookman was alive to that in the beginning, but then he lost his way. And he felt if he could suddenly get these countries reformed. And then, of course, he got into bad press. People accused him of taking sides, Germany against Russia, you know, communism versus anti-communism, that kind of stuff. And pretty soon, whoever heard of the Oxford groups, but people who read some of AA's history. You know, there's a message there. There's a message in their history for our history. You know, just the same as the people who fail in my home group have a message for me. I can learn from their lives and have learned from their lives. And we can learn from this collectively. These people led to an incredible legacy for us of Dr. Silkworth, which you'll hear more from, Carl Jung, who treated a man and treated him, because Jung knew from his own experience that psychology can only go so far. The other ingredient is magic, some kind of spiritual dimension. So when Roland, after a long year of study and deep psychotherapy with Carl Jung, got drunk again and returned to Jung and said, "Can't you help me?" Jung said, "No, I've done everything I can do for you. You need some kind of spiritual healing now." And he pointed him in the direction of the Oxford groups. And lo and behold, Roland got sober. And he carried the message to Ebby, you know, and he and Ebby carried the message to Bill, just like you're doing in your life. You're carrying the message to somebody else that there is a way. You don't have to live like that any longer, that there is linkage here. And if we stay true to that and don't get distracted by other things, we're going to be around another 58 years, God willing. And thank you for listening. I'm going to turn it over to my friend John.
Thank you, Frank. A wealth of knowledge. So then we have an announcement. Linda Smith, who wrote this? Okay, I can't read it. Linda Smith or Barbara Lorenzo? Call Barbara Lorenzo. You got it? Okay. So we took care of that. Now, Stu, I need some help. I need to get this set up about three rows down by Ray. If you can... That, and the wire for it is over there. Because this is the... We're going to show the slides as soon as I get finished with this little story of the big book. So Frank brings us up to the time that Ebby takes the message to Bill Wilson. And that was in November of 1934. Ebby visits Bill and tells him his story and brings him the six steps that the Oxford groups, or at least they were, Ebby and Roland Hazard and Zebra Graves were using. December 1934, Bill Wilson has his white wind, white light spiritual experience at Towns Hospital. From December 1934 to May of 1935, Bill works with as many alcoholics as he can get his hands on around New York City. Of course, he has no success in getting anyone else to get sober or stay sober, but Bill himself stays sober. Himself trying to carry the message to another sick and suffering alcoholic. Then in May of 1935, Bill is in Akron, Ohio on a business trip, which ultimately fails, but it's there that he meets Dr. Barb, our co-founder. Mother's Day, Bill is in the Mayflower Hotel, the lobby, the picture of which we have here. And the business deal had gone sour. He had gone out thinking he was going to become the chief executive officer of some big manufacturing company. But his reputation preceded him, and they voted him out. So he was alone and lonely in a city called Akron, Ohio. And he needed another drunk to talk to. There was a directory in that lobby, and that directory had some names on it. And he called one Walter Tunks, who was also an Oxford member, and he referred him to Henrietta Seiberling. And Henrietta asked Bill to come on over. Now, here's a woman who hears this guy from New York City. He said, "Hey, I'm a rumhead from New York City. I need another drunk to talk to." And she said, "Well, come on over." It's hard for me to understand why a woman would do that. Until you realize that Henrietta was also involved in the Oxford movement. You know, Carl Jung talked at one time, and he came up with a thing called synchronicity. Synchronicity is where seemingly unrelated forces are at work, and they culminate at a certain time. And we're going to see this throughout Alcoholics Anonymous. You probably can see it in your own life. We call them coincidences a lot of times, but it's called synchronicity. And we have these forces at work. Henrietta's been out there in the Oxford groups working. One of her friends, Dr. Bob, she'd been trying to get him sober in the Oxford movement, no luck. So when Bill calls, she invites him over. She's going to put those two together. Well, they're not able to get together that day because it's Mother's Day, and when Henrietta calls Ann over,
Anna to ask Bob to come over. And she said, well, I said, Henrietta, you know it's Mother's Day. And Bob is here. He brought me a potted plant, and he's potted under the table, so I don't think we can make it today. So the next day they made arrangements where they met, and the loving relationship, which was to culminate in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous another month later, began. Dr. Bob didn't get sober that day, but he...
Obsession of the mind by a stock manipulator from New York City. And Dr. Bob said, this is the first time I've ever talked to a person who seemed to know what he was talking about. And so Dr. Bob got drunk one more time. June the 10th, 1935 is when we say Alcoholics Anonymous was founded. That's the day that Bob had his last drink that morning before he performed an operation that was scheduled. And I'm sure that that day, as Bob drank his last beer, went into the hospitals, and I'm sure I can just see him and Bill saying, well, congratulations, we just founded Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't happen that way. They didn't know till afterwards that that's what had happened. And so Dr. Bob has his last drink, and Billy spends the summer there in Akron with Dr. Bob and Ann. He eventually goes back that fall to New York and gets busy. And Dr. Bob and Bill meet again in 1937, in the fall of 1937. And during that time, between 1935 and 1937, Bill and Lois are members of the Oxford groups, and they go to meetings. That's what they do, and then they talk to other drunks, and some of them move into Bill's home, et cetera, et cetera. But in the fall of 1937, they're together again in Akron, Ohio, and they began to count heads. Those who are sober in and around Akron, and those who are sober on the east in and around New York, and they suddenly realized that there were 40 people sober using that little method. The two had suddenly become four in a couple of two and a half years. And they began to talk, how could they carry this message? What could they do to get this message to others? Because they knew there were millions of alcoholics, probably some within the sound of their voice, that were dropping dead, and they needed to know what they knew. So they began to think of methods to do that. Of course, they brought up the idea that they needed hospitals, because they knew at that time hospitals didn't want anything to do with drunks. So they'd build a chain of hospitals that would treat alcoholics. And then they would need some missionaries. They would have missionaries go out and tell the story of how this thing was working. And it wasn't called AA at that time, but I'll use that term loosely. And then lastly, they said, well, we'll need some literature. We'll need a book of our experience to put into print. And Dr. Bob listened, and he said, you know, I think we ought to bring this before the group here in Akron, in which they did. They had a meeting at Clarice Williams, T. Henry and Clarice Williams' home. You'll see their picture, and the home is on the wall somewhere. They had a meeting at that house that night and brought up these ideas about hospitals and missionaries. And the 18 people that met that night didn't like the idea of any of it. They said, hospitals are a racket. We don't want anything to do with that. Missionaries, who's going to pay them? None of us got a job, so we can't pay missionaries. And books, we don't need any literature. After all, the 12 apostles didn't need any literature. This was their thinking, see. The Oxford group is a very spiritual regeneration movement. It's been compared to first century Christianity. So they didn't see the need for any of that stuff. That's where most of them were grounded, even though some of them were recovering alcoholics, not all of them. But they finally had a vote because Dr. Bob supported Bill. They had a vote, and by the barest majority, they said, well, let's go for the whole shooting match, the hospitals, the literature, the missionaries. And though, because they knew very well that Bill would have to go back to New York City to raise that money. And so that's what Bill did. He went back to New York City. He was all excited and told those New York drunks what they were going to do, and they were more excited. They supported Bill 100%. Big deal in New York. They liked those ideas, building hospitals and stuff. So they set about to try to raise some money. Very shortly, they found out, after knocking on a couple of doors, that they were not going to be successful in raising money for drunks. It just wasn't a good idea. The folks who had the money says, listen, I think the March of Dimes and United Fund, which they didn't have, and those kinds of organizations deserve our fund. We're not going to give you anything. After all, you brought this thing on yourself. And so Bill got a little disgusted, because Bill was a visionary, there's no doubt in my mind, and he saw us. He saw us gathered together, one alcoholic talking to another and bringing about sobriety to large numbers of folks. He was disappointed, so he went to see his brother-in-law, Leonard Strong. He always went to Leonard Strong, his brother-in-law, when he was down and discussed things with him. And as he went to see Leonard Strong and told him how short-sighted these rich people were, they weren't coming forth with any money, he was disgusted with it all, and Leonard brought to his attention the idea that at one time he knew a fellow who was connected to the Rockefellers, Willard Richardson. If he was still alive, he might remember him. I'll call him up. He called him up. Willard Richardson remembered and asked Leonard to send this fellow on over. Bill gets in touch with the Rockefeller connection and begins to tell him what they're doing. A couple of meetings occur, and then they finally have a big meeting at the Rockefeller headquarters, in which Leonard Harrison, Leroy Chipman, Frank Amos, Albert Scott were all members and supporters of the Rockefeller Foundation, and they all met with Bill, who brought Dr. Bob and some other alcoholics in and around New York. And they had this meeting, and they said that they told this group a little bit about their recovery and what it was like now, and told them what they wanted to do. And this committee listened to them intently, and then they began to object using the same objectives or the same arguments that those folks in Akron had used. They said, won't money spoil this thing? Hospitals are a racket. You know, the business management of hospitals is not good. Missionaries will spoil the man-to-man approach that seems to be working, etc. So they had good arguments. And, of course, the argument on our side was, well, we've considered that. We think that it's worth the risk to do nothing is even more perilous. So that made good sense to them, and so they decided to do a study of Alcoholics Anonymous as a means by which to perhaps ask Mr. Rockefeller for some money. Frank Amos was appointed the person to make the study, and he went to Akron, Ohio, spent a few days over there investigating us, the Alcoholics Anonymous, asking about Dr. Bob, going to a meeting or two, and he found an abandoned house over there that could have been converted into a hospital. And they knew that if they had a hospital, they wanted it to be where Dr. Bob could superintend it for a couple of reasons. Dr. Bob, even though he was sober a couple and a half years, or about 3 years at this time, his practice had failed to revive. He was not doing much medically speaking, and he was getting into trouble financially. And so that if there was a hospital, they wanted him to take care of it. But Dr. Bob was a proctologist. And after about 3 years, his reputation preceded him, and not too many people were willing to bend over with a knife in this guy's hand. So he was having a difficult time getting his practice together. But they found a place that they could open as a hospital. Frank Amos came back with his report, gave it to Richardson, who in turn gave it to Mr. Rockefeller. The report was a glowing report about us, and it had recommended as a starter that Mr. Rockefeller give us $50,000. He took that report into Mr. Rockefeller and at the same time made his own glowing report of what he had been able to observe with Bill and so on and so forth. And John D. Rockefeller looked at the report and read it over, and he said something to the effect that, I think money will spoil this thing. I don't think that giving these folks money would be a good idea. They seem to be doing real good man-to-man. Hospitals and all those things would be a bad investment. And so John D. Rockefeller right then and there saved us from ourselves. It's hard to imagine what might have happened to us had he gave us that $50,000. We would have been compromised in a heartbeat. Probably before they got that money in the bank, there'd be fights and arguments and everybody'd been drunk, and AA may not have been here. But he was right on the money. Albert Scott also saw that. He asked this question, won't money spoil this thing? And that's what John D. had asked, won't money spoil this thing? And so he refused to give us any money. And then at that time, Mr. Richardson told John D. Rockefeller of the financial plight of Bill and Dr. Bob. And so John D. says, well, here's what I'll do for you. I'll put $5,000 in trust at the Riverside Church, which was his church, for these guys to use. And when that money's used up, that's it. Don't ever ask me for any more money. And so what seemed to our little group at that time like bad news turns out to be good news. Because we know now, looking back, what money would have done for us. So The money was to be used, and Dr. Bob and Bill drew on that at $30 a week for a period of time. But that they didn't give up their hopes of raising money. And this Rockefeller bunch had caught the spirit of recovery, and they wanted to still help. And so they had regular meetings as the boys in New York City started trying to raise money. And Bill wrote his story and what is now known as the chapter, There is a Solution. He wrote these stories and they were printed up and they were used as money-raising paraphernalia. That is, they would go knock on the doors of these folks who they thought might be willing to give us some contribution and gave them these two chapters and says, read this over, this is who we are, da-da-da. But still, they were not having any luck. And so 1938, in the spring of 1938, a tax-free charitable foundation was established. It was set up so that if they did get any money from any wealthy contributors, they'd have a tax write-off for themselves. So they set up, of course, this foundation ultimately leads to the General Service Office as we know it today. Sometime in March of April, Bill began to work on the big book. He completed his story in the second chapter of the book, as I mentioned. These were mimeographed and was part of the paraphernalia for raising money. The trustees continued to have these monthly meetings to talk about and look at an empty treasure. In the fall of 1938, Frank Amos, who had made that investigation of us, set up a meeting between Bill and the religious editor of Harper's Magazine. His name was Eugene Exman. That's his picture over there. And he wanted Bill, they made an appointment for Bill to go down and see him. And Bill took his two chapters that he had written down to Eugene Exman. Eugene looks him over and he asks him a couple of questions like, can you write a whole book in this style, using this style? And if so, how long would it take you? And Bill says, well, yes, I think I can. It'd probably take me about 10 months or so. And Mr. Exman then made a proposition that seemed fantastic to Bill at the time. He says, well, if you think it'll help, I'll make you an advance of $1,500 towards the royalty. And, well, that sounded real good at that time. And Bill left the office knowing that that amount of money would be deducted when the book was finally published, but he felt pretty good about it until he started thinking on the way to break the news to the foundation. He said, well, and these were thoughts that he had coming right out of AA Comes of Age. What if this fellowship becomes successful and our book is owned by someone else? He said he thought that we ought to own our own book. But the foundation, when they heard the proposal made by the magazine that they would advance us $1,500, they thought that was the answer. Let's take the deal. But Bill argued his point, and, you know, they were at a stalemate. So nothing really happened. Until a fellow by the name of Henry Hank Parkhurst gets in the picture. Now, Hank Parkhurst had been sober a couple of years at that time. He came out of town's hospital. He's a former oil executive. He had red hair, as is described. He had a lot of energy, and he had a new idea coming out of him every half minute. And Hank tells Bill, he says, Bill, he says, this foundation ain't never raised any money for you, and they ain't going to. He says, what we need to do is to put this book on a business-like basis. He says, what we need to do is form a corporation and sell stock. Well, Bill admitted that he had been toying with such an idea, but he didn't have the brass things that Hank had about that. Hank was just persuasive. And he says, we ain't got time to mess with that foundation. And but Bill says, we're not incorporated. We don't have anything like that. We don't have money to do that. So Henry went down that evening to the local bookstore, and he brought him a blank pad of stock certificates. Across the top, he writes, Works Publishing Incorporated. Down at the bottom, he signs, Hank Parkhurst, President. And when he gave him the bill the next day, Bill protested the irregularity, and Bill says, we ain't got no time to waste. We got to get busy here. And then they tried to sell these phony certificates to the New York drunks, and none of them bought any. They wouldn't buy it, and these drunks in New York City said, the nerve, you trying to sell us stock in a book you haven't even written yet, for God's sakes. And then Hank got busy with a prospectus showing how much money they would make in this book. And you got to remember this. The Oxford groups had been very successful in selling books. They had sold a lot of books, hundreds of thousands of books. And, of course, this is where Henry was coming from, no doubt where Bill was coming from. If they could get a book together and sell them by the carloads, for God's sakes, just think how much money they would make. And so they established this corporation with 600 shares. Bill was going to get two of them, 200 for writing the book. Henry was going to get 200 for managing the affairs. And then there would be 200 that they would be able to sell for people who would want to buy stock. And the author's royalties would be used to offset expenses. Well, he got this perspective showing how much money they would make if they sold 100,000 books, a 500,000 books, et cetera, et cetera. Bill said, I don't remember what it was, but it was fantastic, the amount of money they were going to make. But they couldn't get anybody to buy them stocks. And then Henry came up with an idea. Says, let's go down to Reader's Digest and see if they'll do an article. Says, these guys, these drunks ain't going to split with no money until we give them a good argument. He goes to the Reader's Digest, talks to Payne, who was the managing editor at the Reader's Digest. And Mr. Payne says, you know, that sounds like the kind of stuff we'd like to write about. You know, the Rockefeller connection and alcoholics getting sober. And then he will put a plug for the book. But he says, you know, sounds good to me, but I have to bring it up with my other editors and see if they're in favor of it, and I'll let you know. Well, it sounded like an endorsement to these two guys, and they go back to New York telling all these drunks that Reader's Digest is going to do an article on them as soon as the book is written. These books are going to sell by the carloads, and guess what? They were able to sell those 200 stocks, shares of stock, to those drunks and alcoholics in New York City. So Bill began to complete the book. He traveled to Newark every morning, dictating the notes and dictated his writings to Ruth Hawk, who was the secretary of this failing little enterprise that Hank had started. They were supposed to be in the selling automobile stuff, waxes, et cetera, but they were more concerned with sobering up drunks than that. But Ruth was the secretary, and she was dictating the book. The chapters were slowly roughed out, and then finally in December 1935, Bill reaches the point called Chapter 5 in our big book. And up until that time, there had been an awful lot of argument about our book, about what went in it, because what used to happen, Bill would dictate to Ruth, she would type it out, then they would go to the meetings, Bill would send it to Akron, Ohio for Dr. Bob to preview, and then they would take it to the meetings that night and tell these drunks what they had written that day. And, of course, they started having these arguments about what it was, you know, I didn't like the way you said that, that's not the way it is, da-da-da-da-da-da. So they got into all these arguments about it. So Bill was disgusted with it. As a matter of fact, he said at times, I felt like throwing that damn book right out the window, because he felt more like an umpire in a fight than he did as an author of the book. But he reached this point in December of 1938. It was a critical point. He knew that the backbone of this book needed to be placed right here. He'd done what he called enough window dressing. And so he was not in a spiritual mood on this night, and he lay in bed with a pencil and pad in his hand. Now, he liked to write in the bed. You know, he's one of those guys that did his best in the bed. I understand that a little bit. He reflected on all that had occurred since Abby's visit in the fall of 1934. The program had evolved into what they called the word-of-mouth program. It wasn't AA. It was the word-of-mouth program. Most of the basic ideas came from the Oxford groups, of course, as Frank had alluded to, William James, who wrote Varieties of Religious Experiences, and Dr. Silkworth, who described our disease. And it looked like this. The first step said we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. The second step said we made a moral inventory of our defects of sin. Three, we confessed or shared our shortcomings with another person in confidence. Four, we made restitution to all those we had harmed by our drinking. And five, we tried to help other alcoholics with no thought of reward in money or prestige. And six, we prayed to whatever God we thought there was for the power to practice these precepts. Now, this is what Abby had brought Bill in November of 1934. And everybody was using Dr. Silkworth's expression describing the alcoholic's dilemma of obsession and allergy. That's what everybody was using that. That was part of the pitch. By then, AA knew from experience that the new prospect had to accept step one or get no place. We admitted we were licked, that we were powerless over alcohol. That was the first step. If you didn't accept that, you couldn't go anyplace. Now, Bill's mind ran over these developments, and it seemed to him that the program was not definite enough. He thought that the AA literature would have to be clear and comprehensive, that the steps would have to be more explicit, There must not be a single loophole through which the rationalizing alcoholic could wiggle out of. That was his thinking. He knew it well. So Bill started to write this evening. He relaxed and asked for guidance, which I think is probably the most important thing he did based on what happened. And with speed that was astonishing, Bill completed the first draft. It took about 30 minutes. 30 minutes. The words kept on coming, and when Bill reached the stopping point, he numbered the new steps. They added up to 12. He connected these steps with the 12 apostles. It seemed like a good number to him. Followed him throughout. He wrote in 12s all the time. Then he was visited by a couple of drunks. There was a guy by the name of Howard, and he had a protege under his wing. And Howard read over what Bill had just written, and he began to have some objections about too much God being in there and getting alcoholics on their knees, and they began to argue like hell about what Bill had just written. And Bill defended almost with his life every word he had written. And they didn't get quiet until Lois finally came in and said, "You guys are going to have to be quiet. Have a cup of coffee." And then Howard began to see some of the magic of these steps and began to agree with them a little bit. And it was from that point forward that the book was written. And there are three factions of us alcoholics that existed at that time that whose input was to make up the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And these factions were the conservatives. The conservative were the Fitz Mayo. He was a preacher's son who lived in Maryland. Fitz Mayo and that bunch wanted the book to be written in biblical terms, quoting the Bible, etc., etc. These were the conservatives. And then there were the liberals. The liberals had no objections to the word God in our book, but they were against any theological or religious position. They didn't want to take any positions with respect to those ideas. Spirituality, yes. Religion, no. Positively, no. Their position. And then there were the radicals. These were the Jimmy Burwells, the Hank Parkhurst. These were the guys who were the atheists or non-believers. They were agnostic. They wanted a psychological book without any God in it. So these three factions were the ones that Bill heard the arguing about. The conservatives who wanted the biblical book, the liberals who wanted spirituality, no theology, and then the radicals who didn't want God mentioned in this book. And boy, you can just imagine, you get those three factions in a room trying to decide on a point, and Bill was here again. The refereeing started. And he got caught in the middle of it. He was the one that was writing it, and he got caught in the middle of the argument. Now, the liberals were the larger group, but they barely outnumbered the combined conservatives and radicals. It looked like the book would bog down into permanent disagreement. And Bill finally asked this question, that he might be the final judge of what the book said. And he said, "If it don't work that way, I'm going to abandon the book and you guys can write it." And, of course, these guys all looked at each other and said, "I don't know anything about writing a book. I don't believe I want to write a book." So they said, "Okay, Bill, you write it." And so that's how he got his way with writing the book. And then as they were finishing the book, they knew that something else was needed. That's when they decided to put some testimonials in the back of the book, the stories, the 36 stories that were in the first book. Then they began to have after-meeting discussions about what to call this book. There were several titles that were considered. Of course, Alcoholics Anonymous was one of the titles. The Way Out was another title. 100 Men, The Empty Glass, The Dry Way, The Dry Life, Dry Frontiers, and so on and so forth. Bill liked Alcoholics Anonymous, but The Way Out seemed to be the most popular. And this is when, and it seemed like they had the bare majority, this is when Bill used Fitz Mayo, who was in Maryland. They said, calls him up and says, "Fitz, go over to the Library of Congress and check for us and see how many books they're entitled The Way Out and how many books they're entitled Alcoholics Anonymous." So next day, Fitz sends a telegram to Bill. He says, "There are 12 books entitled The Way Out. There are no books called Alcoholics Anonymous." So the argument was, "Folks, we don't want to be the 13th Way Out." So they all said, "No, we don't. Let's..." So they stamped the mimeographed copies of the book because they had mimeographed 400 copies of the book as it was written because they needed to make sure that they hadn't made any major mistakes. And they sent these books out to people in religion, people in psychology, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted them to preview. And if they had any comments, they wanted it to come back. But so they hadn't named the book at this time, so they stamped the mimeographed copy, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how the book got its name, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, that's how the fellowship got its name. And so they had arguments about the title of the book and so on and so forth. They had arguments about how much to charge for the book. They settled on a price of $3.50. They finally go to Cornwall Press in New York to get the Back Galleys written. And as they were about to get the book printed in the early part of 1939, they remembered nobody had been in touch with Reader's Digest. We better go down and let him know the book's about to be published. They go down to see Mr. Payne. Mr. Payne says, "Who are you?" Henry walks in and says, "We're ready to shoot." That's how he walks in the door, and Mr. Payne said, "Shoot what?" And then they brought him up to date, and he reminded, "Oh, yes, you two guys were here a few months ago. Interesting thing. Remember I told you that I thought the idea was good, but I had to bring it up with my managing editors," which I did. And he says, to my surprise, they didn't like the idea. Far too controversial, et cetera, and I forgot to let you guys know. Well, of course, their mouth drops, and they got to run back to New York, or not run. They hated to go back to New York to break this news to their stockholders, that the Reader's Digest was, in fact, not going to write an article. And so soon they would have 5,000 copies of this book and no market for them. And so it was a real bummer. Now, in April of 1939, the printing had been done and the book was published. That was the date of the first book. There were some reviews. Now, how did we get the title The Big Book? Well, in order to make the alcoholic think that he was getting his money's worth, they ordered Cornwall Press to print this book on the thickest paper possible. And they had wide margins so that when the book came out, and the original copy of the big book, or the book, was a big red covered with gold printing book, and it was so large and cumbersome, that's how it got its name. Lovingly, they call it the big book, because it was probably, for $3.50, the biggest book you could buy. So that's how we got to calling it the big book. But they didn't have any market for it. They couldn't get rid of them. They had these 5,000 copies of which they hadn't paid for. They were in a bonded warehouse. And how would they get any publicity? And one day a member came up with a good idea. And his name was Morgan. And at one time he was in the advertising business and he knew Gabriel Heater. Gabriel Heater was like the Tonight Show today. He was on National Hookup. He did a 3-minute radio show. It was called We the People. Morgan says, "I'll go down and see Gabriel Heater. If he remembers, maybe he'll give us a hand. Maybe he'll interview me and maybe do a piece about the book." He goes down, comes back with the great news that Gabriel Heater has decided to interview him and to plug the book. The date was set for was just a little over a week away, and then someone sounded a note of caution. Now Morgan had just recently been released from an insane asylum. And they began to think, what if Morgan is drunk on the day of the broadcast? What will we do? Well, Hank Parkhurst came up with a wonderful idea. We'll put him in a damn room and put a guard on the door so he can't escape. And so somebody had a membership in the Downtown Athletic Club, and this is exactly what they did. They took Morgan down there, put him in that room, would not let him out, fed him. Somebody stood on the door the whole time for a whole week. But finally, during that week, Hank not only prevailed in getting him locked up, he also says, "Now listen, we need to do some advertising if this radio show is going off. What we need to do is send a postcard to all the positions east of the Mississippi reminding them to listen to this program and to buy a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, A Sure Cure for Alcoholism. And as a matter of fact, the postcard, a picture of it is on the wall around here somewhere. Pretty interesting reading. But thing is, they didn't have any money for that. So they borrowed $400, put together 2,000 of these postcards and mailed them out. And finally, on the given day, Morgan shows up. He does the radio show. The transcript of that show is in the book, Pass It On. Pretty good job, I think, they did that day. And all of the alcoholics in the Midwest and all of those who were sober at that time who knew the show was going, you could just all see him there with their ears tuned to their radio, waiting for Morgan to come on, wondering if he would come on. And there he was. He came on and did a real good job, and of course Gabriel Heater put in a plug for Alcoholics Anonymous and the book. Then Ruth, Bill, and Hank waited 72 hours before they went down to the post office to get all these postcards that they knew would be mailed back to them requesting a copy of the book. 3 days they restrained themselves, and then on the third day they each had a suitcase. And they went down to the post office. And then when they got in the post office, they looked in this little glass window, and they saw a handful of postcards. Bill's mouth dropped, and Henry says, don't worry about it. He says, they probably got them by the bagfuls in the back. Called the mail clerk over and says, we're here to get our postcards. And the mail clerk said, well, that's it. You mean you don't have any in the back? Nope, that's it. So these suitcases were of no good. They had about 12 responses to the radio show. Another $400 down the tube. Borrowed money at that. So Henry had a lot of good ideas, but they fizzled. A few days later, 1939, Bill was evicted. Bill, they were evicted from their office in New Jersey. Here it is, 1939. Bill is not working. He hadn't worked since 1935. Then on one day, he was visiting Charlie Towns, who was a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the owner of the hospital where Bill got sober, Towns Hospital, New York City. Charlie knew Morris Markey, who was a feature writer for the Liberty magazine. And Towns had made arrangements for Bill to go see this guy. And Mr. Owsler, Fulton Owsler, who owned the magazine, had commissioned Markey to do an article. And so he wanted to interview Bill, and so the arrangements were made, and Markey soon had an article called Alcoholics and God. It appeared in the September 1939 issue of Liberty magazine. This time they had hoped and really had turned the corner. The magazine received 800 urgent pleas for help, which were promptly turned over to Bill and Ruth. Several hundred books were sold at full retail. And even more important, they began to strike up a correspondence with alcoholics everywhere. In 1940, Henry got drunk over a dispute with Bill as to where the office should be located. Bill wanted the office close to him in New York City. Henry wanted he wanted it with him, and he wanted Ruth to go with him. Bill turned over his 200 shares of stock to the foundation and persuaded Henry to do the same. Eventually, the 200 that were sold were purchased back. John D. Rockefeller gave a dinner in 1940 for AA, which received worldwide attention and news coverage and added to the credit of Alcoholics Anonymous. John D. Rockefeller didn't give us any money, but he gave us his people, and he gave us his name. He was a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. In March 1941, there were about 2,000 members when Jack Alexander's article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. And by the end of 1941, we had 8,000 members, a 400% increase in 1 year, primarily as a result of Jack Alexander's article. The core of the big book, the first 164 pages, which were first published in 1939, are still in place and remain unchanged. That's what we'll be studying this weekend. Because of the experience of millions in recovered alcoholics, the word and instructions we'll be looking at this weekend are more valid today than they ever were. We have much more experience, and every day a new day of experience makes our program even more valuable and more valid. Now, in a short time, we're going to begin our study, but before we do that, I want to make a request that we get real clear about the weekend in that we need to leave the distractions outside. When Stuart started this meeting with that moment of silence, you notice he took a moment. And that moment, I think, is for us to get grounded so that we just leave the distractions, because sometimes we're busy people. We run in and we didn't get our seat and the registration wasn't handled right, da-da-da. And all of that conversation is going on. But when we get here, we want to be real focused. Because if we're real focused on what's going to be going on here, we're going to be able to receive the information and be able to digest it and be able to understand it. So I'm requesting now that you just, when you get here and you sit down, remember what I have, and you can't see it all up there, but the time is now, the place is here. This is the only reality. The time is right now. We don't have anything else. It's not yesterday. It's not tomorrow. It's right now. So let's be here. Now, what Frank is going to do is... I think Frank is going to do this. You ready? You got your automatic. Now, are the lights down so you can...
You want to use this thing?
Yes. Exactly enough time.
You can pull it out as hard as you want.
Let me just see if I can elevate that a little bit.
We're going to quickly go through... some of the images, as John indicated, they're around the room, and talk a little bit about their contribution to what we have here today. This is William James, and he's the author of Varieties of a Religious Experience, which was a seminal book, and Ebby gave Bill a copy of it when Bill was in Towns Hospital. It's hard to believe Bill was able to read it, but he read it and was influenced greatly by the vast varieties of ways that people can have a conversion experience, that you can think things differently in a number of ways that can happen to you. The educational variety is the way most of us have it. Next slide, Bill. This is the copy of the Varieties of Religious Experience. It's still in print. There's a particularly well-edited copy that's prepared by Harvard University, a new edition of it. Thanks, Bill. This is the Richard Peabody book, The Common Sense of Drinking. As I mentioned, this was a bestseller. John indicated that they were very disappointed in sales of the big book. One of the measurements they had for a successful book was Richard Peabody's, which sold in the millions. This was in 1932 it was published, and it literally sold in the millions. And this is Roland Hazard, the man on the right with his mother and dad. He was the man that was later to become the carrier of Message to Bill, the man treated by Roland, by Carl Jung. This is Carl Jung, a very famous psychotherapist. And this is Seba Graves, the man who carried with Roland the message to Ebby. Frank Bookman, profoundly charismatic man, and the founder of the Oxford groups. I was a pagan, and for sinners only. They had powerful titles, these books. These were the Oxford groups. The For Sinners Only by A.J. Russell was considered the basic text of the Oxford groups. And I think there was something like 100 and some odd printings of that book. So that was a runaway bestseller. And A.J. Russell is the man who did God Calling, which became the basis for the 24-hour book. He was a newspaper man, and he went there much like Jack Alexander to criticize really the Oxford groups, and he became a convert. Next slide, Bill. Here are some of the early writings of the Oxford groups. They were a little publishing empire because people were they were all readers in those days, long before television, and everybody read a lot of books. Next. This is the opening page of their basic textbooks, which I can't read by now, but it goes on to say that the Oxford groups is a non-denominational thing, that they don't have any membership lists. They're not a lot of the stuff, the essence of what's in our preamble, that really they don't own property. They're not interested in that. Frank Bookman had a principle: where God guides, God provides. He never solicited money publicly. He never had fundraisers, whatever. He just assumed that wherever he would go, there'd be enough money to support him. And it seemed to be true. And those sentiments. Here's Bill and Ebby at the Roosevelt Hotel for the, I think it's the third General Service Conference. And here's Calvary Church, where Sam Shoemaker was the rector. And since the Oxford groups didn't own any property by choice, they used, in New York, they used the Calvary Church, Sam Shoemaker, as their headquarters. And this is a parish, kind of parish house of Calvary Church, Calvary House, and that's where the offices were. Here's Sam Shoemaker, another big writer and preacher, and very influential man. Bill has, in the 1955 International Convention in St. Louis, Sam Shoemaker was one of the speakers, so his talk is in AA Comes of Age. It's a very powerful talk. And here's Dr. Silkworth, the little doctor. He treated something like 40,000 drunks in his lifetime at Towns Hospital, and then he went on to Knickerbocker Hospital. Wrote the doctor's opinion. Here's Towns Hospital. It's still there. The building is still there on Central Park West and 89th Street. It's now an apartment building. I sponsored somebody who lived there, so it's still full of drunks. They're just not in formal treatment anymore. I think it closed around 1955. And then Dr. Silkworth left Towns and went to Knickerbocker Hospital. And that's a lot of drunks got sober there. Here's the, John mentioned the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel where Bill got the name Walter Tunks. Next slide. And Tunks, happy, cheerful looking man, isn't he? And he led, next slide, led Bill through a various process. Oh, here's a very interesting thing. This is the big paper in Akron, Ohio, and I think it's 1932. But Harvey Firestone was the town drunk, and Bud Firestone was the town drunk, and his father Harvey, through a series of events, was able to get him mixed up with the Oxford groups, and lo and behold, Bud Firestone got sober. And that was a big thing in Akron. And out of gratitude, his father brought a lot of people from the Oxford groups to Akron. And you can see it was big news in Akron. He brought Sam Shoemaker. He brought Frank Bookman. He brought a lot of the principal power people for a whole week of talks in Akron. And that's where Dr. Bob and Ann Smith began getting involved with the Oxford groups. And here's Henrietta, one of musical moments, and her gatehouse should be next. You'll have to imagine her gatehouse. Bill, do you want to lose your cushy job? Oh. Slide stuff. I'm glad I'm not there. Well, anyway, Bud Firestone did indeed get sober, and that was a very powerful convincement to Dr. Bob that he could get sober. And I think from 1932, when he saw the newspaper and began attending, until he met Bill in the summer of 1935, Dr. Bob tried the Oxford groups. And he went and he made his decision. He did all the things right, but he still continued to drunk. So it's very poignant. I think it's 2.5 years. He went to Oxford group meetings until he met Bill and then was able to get sober. And Bill independently was going to Oxford group meetings for 6 months before he met Dr. Bob. So it's what John talked about earlier, synchronicity, just two people meeting and being able to start a thing. And here we are. Maybe we can do these Saturday night or something. Would we like to do that? Because I know Stu's waiting to close this session. Stu, would you like to...
All right. Thank you very much. We'll get it Saturday night. I will take it.
Am I on? Yes, I'm on. Okay, what we're going to do tonight is continue, first of all, where we left off. What night was that? So long ago, it seems like.
Thursday night.
Thursday night, we were into the slide presentation about some of those folks who had something to do with our history. So we want to finish up with that, and then we'll get on with the rest of the program. So Frank is going to comment about these pictures.
Hi, everybody. My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic. And we're going to hurry through these a little bit because a lot of you have seen them before. And also, many, many, many of them are on the wall. So this is an interesting front page of the Akron Times Press. And it was in 1932, January, some date in 1932. And it was when Frank Bookman and Sam Shoemaker and other members of the Oxford groups went out to Akron. And I mentioned the story of... Harvey Firestone's kid, Bud Firestone, got sober. It was a big event. He was the town drunk, rich kid, very obvious drunk. And lo and behold, he got sober. And he got sober by getting mixed up, as did Bill and Bob, with the Oxford group. So in gratitude, his father brought out an enormous number of people from the Oxford group to put on kind of an evangelical week. And it was during that week that Dr. Bob began to go to Oxford group meetings and met Henrietta and T. Henry Williams and Clarissa and all the gang. So that was the beginning of the seeding of the change that was to happen in Dr. Bob's life that made him receptive to Bill's message when Bill arrived. John? Here's Henrietta Seidling, a musical moment. You remember it was at her gatehouse, which I think is the next slide, John. Yeah, in Akron, where Bill, after the church directory, got in touch with Henrietta and met Bob. It was Mother's Day, 1935. Dr. Bob was going to stay 5 minutes, hours, and got sober. And next slide, John. Here's Bob and Ann Smith, kind of American Gothic. Wonderful. Very spiritual couple. Bill calls him in AA Comes of Age, a naturally spiritual man. Bill had struggles with spirituality, but Dr. Bob apparently was a very natural, and as Ann Smith. Here's another picture of Dr. Bob. And here are the two of them together. This was newspaper one before the anonymity tradition, I think 1942 or 43, in a Vermont newspaper. They are very, very happy, looks like, breaking their anonymity in the newspaper. And here's Ann Smith. She was a very active member of the Oxford groups, and she kept a journal, a notebook, which is very powerful. John? And here's Emmett Fox. Before we had the big book in the early part of AA in the meetings in Akron and in New York, they read Sermon on the Mount. It's a very affirming book. In it, they give the metaphysical understanding of the Lord's Prayer on the back of that book. So if you ever want to have a new idea of the content of the Lord's Prayer, it's a good book to read that in. And here's Modern Man in Search of a Soul, C.G. Jung, a book that influenced Bill. Jung says in this, in one of his essays, he categorically states he has never seen a psychoneuroses recover where the person didn't find a power greater than themselves. So it's very affirming to our whole message of the big book or whatever. John? And here's the King Street School in Akron. They still have a King Street School group. They started to meet here when they got too large for the homes. And I don't think the group meets in King Street School anymore. It may even have outgrown the school. But I'm told there's a plaque of about AA's founding and the early groups in the vestibule of the school. John? And here's City of Akron Hospital, where Dr. Bob worked, where the third man on the bed, Bill D. Bill and Bob called on Bill D. in this hospital. Dr. Bob worked here for a long period of time. And here's St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, where Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob set up a treatment center, and where they dried out the drunks, you remember, in the flower room, and told them about the program. And lots of drunks got sober. Here's Sister Ignatia, a musical moment. She and Dr. Bob treated something like 6,000 or 7,000 drunks at St. Thomas Hospital, and then she moved on to Rosary Hall in Cleveland and continued to serve the alcoholic community. John? Here's the Smith home in Akron. A lot of you have been there. I'm told there are 12 steps leading up to that porch, which is prophetic thing. And that's maintained now, so if you're in Akron, you can visit that place. John? And here's T. Henry Williams' house, where up to 200 members met in that house before they started to branch off. It was in this house on the second floor that Dr. Bob got on his knees and made his, what we call a third step prayer now, made his commitment to God. And here's Bill's brother-in-law, Leonard Strong. He was an osteopathic physician, and he paid Bill's bills at Towns Hospital. And his widow just died this past year, Bill's sister, Dorothy. And he was a big supporter and a member of the Alcoholic Foundation board in the early years. And he was the conduit to Rockefeller. He knew Richardson, Dick Richardson, who was a member of the Rockefeller Foundation. And it was through him that Bill made the connection with the Rockefellers. John? And here's Dick Richardson. They called him Uncle Dick. And he was a clergyman who didn't practice that anymore, but served on the Rockefeller Charity Foundation, and was very, very supportive of AA and became a member of the Alcoholic Foundation board. Keep Billy T away from that machine. I think this is Leonard Harrison, is it? I always get he mixed up. I think it is Leonard Harrison, and he was a member of the Rockefeller board. Rockefeller didn't give us much money. It was to give us $5,000 over some years to loan, and that loan was repaid by the mid-40s. But he gave his people from the Rockefeller Foundation board into the Alcoholic Foundation board, and $1 billion worth of publicity, and a lot of credibility. If you were talking to the Rockefellers in the late 30s and early 40s, people believed you. You know, he gave us a stature that we wouldn't have had probably otherwise. Next. This is Lord Shipman? Thanks. You get a set of dishes if you're right on a number of these. This is Frank Amos, and he was a newspaper man who Rockefeller sent out to check it out in Akron to see if they were the kind of organization that they professed to be. And he came back glowing reports that the thing was magic and that Rockefeller should instantly give it $50,000 and help them set up a string of hospitals, chain of hospitals, and help to hire alcoholic missionaries. And Rockefeller said, no, money would spoil it. I'll only give it a sort of a seeding amount of money and let it do what it's doing already without being messed up by money. John? And here's Frank Exman. He was the religious editor of Harper's. And you remember the story that John told us in the history of the Big Book, that he had urged Harper to offer $1,500 to as an advance to Bill and Hank Parkhurst to publish the Big Book, and they thought about it and they declined, and he thought that was better anyway, that they published their own book. And here's Rockefeller. He came from a Scotch-Irish background, so he probably knew a lot about alcoholism. You know, he was a teetotaler himself. And didn't drink at all, and supported causes that recognized the damage of alcohol in people, including ours. And here's the first office was in Newark, New Jersey, on William Street. And I understand the building's falling apart. I haven't seen it in some years. But here is where they did 40 drafts. Ruth Hawk said there were 40 drafts of the Big Book. You know, Bill would dictate a chapter, and then he'd give it to the New York groups, and then he'd send it out to Akron, and they chopped and screamed and hollered, and she kept typing, typing, typing. She didn't have a word processor, so every little character had to be changed by hand. And here's Ruth Hawk. She's a wonderful woman. Some of you saw her get the 5 million copy of the Big Book in Montreal. And she had left the Alcoholic Foundation, I think, in the 1941 or early 1942. And she hadn't had much contact with AA since then, a little bit. But she was wonderful at that convention, and she died shortly after. So it was a nice revisiting with that woman. And here's, you remember in the history that they couldn't sell many books, and they tried to sell, shares in the book company. They really had some trouble moving these shares. Bill kept 200 of them, Hank Parker's kept 200 of them, and they sold over some years 200 of them to pay the printer for the books. And I think it was about 1942 or 1943 that they redeemed them. that they bought them back or people donated them back. And since then, Alcoholics Anonymous has owned the book. The publishing rights to the book is owned by the fellowship. Here's Bill's house, a rendering of Bill's house, where many, many drunks got sober in that house on Clinton Street. You remember one died on the floor. And here's Bill, it's his office around 1966. He has rubbers on that day with holes in them. And his cigarettes there. And just on the edge is one of the edges of that is you can see his big book. He had a circus-covered big book, a first edition. And in behind him is a wonderful thing we still have at the office. It's a picture of the 1960 Montreal Convention, and it was signed by many, many, many of the people there, and he loved it. And here's Lois. You can capture some of her charismatic quality in these pictures. This is a picnic up at Stepping Stones. This is anybody's guess. Is this a 100 unit one, John, or an 88? 88, yeah, because the 100 ones, they often do get stuck in them. But I didn't think it happened in the smaller ones. It's probably the chewing gum that fell in there, John. You shouldn't do two things at once. Oh, it's her? Well, you're a patient group. In a theater, you'd be throwing your popcorn and Coke ice. One more minute, and then we hit it. We're all set. This man was the rector of Riverside Church, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and he was the conduit of the money. You remember from AA Comes of Age that Rockefeller gave this man the money in trust to dole it out to Bill, I think, Bill and Bob, $30 a week, excuse me, and pay some of the bills at the office so that they wouldn't have all the money together. And this is Jack Alexander, the man who wrote the Saturday Evening Post article. You remember John saying that we had 2,000 members on March 1st, 1941, when this issue was published. And within a year, we had 8,000 members, a fourfold increase in 1 year. So you can imagine what the groups were like. Yeah. These are some of the early pamphlets. Medicine Looks at Alcoholics Anonymous. Some early supporters, physicians wrote wonderful articles, republication of the article in Saturday Evening Post, and a lot of other early support. And here's Ed Dowling, Father Dowling, Jesuit, met Bill in the early 40s, I think 1940, 1941, on a rainy day. He went to the 24th Street Clubhouse and met Bill, and Bill thought, oh, another wet drunk coming in on a rainy day, and is going to talk forever, and they were instant friends and stayed friends until Dowling died in sometime in the early 50s, I think. And he was a first Catholic supporter of the program. This was the entrance to the 24th Street Clubhouse. You see on the top it said The Last Mile, and it was a building behind a building. You walk through this alleyway, an enclosed alleyway, so it was really dark, but at the end, it was very symbolic. At the end you saw the light at the end of the tunnel, and the last mile. You can imagine what a drunk felt like when he was being brought into this little darkened alley. And up over the 24th Street Clubhouse itself were rooms, and Bill and Lois, after they lost their home on Brooklyn Heights for non-payment of the mortgage, it was foreclosed under them, lived in these small rooms over the 24th Street Clubhouse. So Bill made enormous sacrifices for the before the fellowship in the early years. And here's some portraits. It was kind of a cheerful place inside from the pictures. There's Bill, Bob, and Dr. Silkworth. Portraits. And here's the entrance to it. So you went into that dark little alley. It was on West 24th Street. It's no longer there. It's part of a high-rise complex now. And here, after they left the 24-hour club, they moved over here to 41st Street. You see that bar restaurant sign, restaurant bar sign? It was a Norman Vincent Peale church, a marble collegiate church, and that had fallen on hard times and became a restaurant bar, and then it became an AA group, an AA clubhouse. So it was really on the skids here. It's now the entrance to the Lincoln Tunnel, one of the entrances to the Lincoln Tunnel. And here's a lot of organizations don't have canceled checks to the Rockefellers. You see, this is the one on top, John D. Rockefeller. They were paying him the loan over some years. I think that's 1943. 1943, June 4th, 1943. These were some of the last payments to John D. Rockefeller, the December 1942. Not a lot of organizations have canceled checks paying money back to Rockefeller. But we learned through him self-support tradition. And the lowest check was to Charlie Towns Hospital. And here's Harry Tebow, psychiatrist. By the way, if you want to give a treat to your group, there's something called Markings on a Journey, and it's a 38-minute film strip or video cassette of the early history of AA. And on it, it's on the order form, the AA order form. And on it, they give the voices of people like Harry Tebow, Sister Ignatia, Bill and Bob, of course, but a lot of people who were instrumental in the early years of AA. And to hear them speak is a very powerful thing because their voices are like fingerprints. You get a sense of them when you hear them. And Harry Tebow's one, and he talks about the magic in that excerpt that they have from his talk. He talks about the magic years of AA. You know, we've all felt these when we first walk in AA, the fellowship, you know, when your early sobriety, when everything is possible. You know, we all want to become counselors in the first half hour, you know, and tell everybody we're invincible, you know, and we know how everything works in those early years. We lose that. But he captures some of that as a group, what the early years were like, you know, miracles happening all throughout AA. And it's wonderful to hear that and refresh our own mind and sense, really, we're still at the very beginning of AA. We've by no means reached saturation point, in, as you know, with alcoholics. And here's the one I always mistake. This is Harrison. Is he not Leonard Harrison? That first was Leroy Chipman. This is Leonard Harrison. And another very powerful component to the Alcoholic Foundation Board by way of the Rockefeller Foundation. And here's Marty Mann. You know, she was to write The Primer on Alcoholism, a very powerful book, and start the National Council on Alcohol Education. She got sober at Blythewood through a book. Tebow, I think, was her psychiatrist. He gave her one of the early books. I think it was even a pre-publication manuscript of the big book. And lo and behold, she got sober. And here's a touching note that Bill wrote to Ebby. You remember, Ebby was the man with all the enthusiasm and conviction, carried the message to Bill during an alcoholic, the end of Bill's drinking. And then he drank again and again and again. He was to die sober. He had 6 months sobriety when he died. But Bill always considered him his sponsor. Did you read it? Something? Oh, okay. Next, John. And here's Bill at the 10th anniversary of Dr. Bob's death, kind of a reflective moment. You get a sense of his personality. And here's the first International Convention, Cleveland, 1950. I've forgotten how many. I think 2,100 people were there. Next one is Oh, here. This is from an Akron paper. The 10th anniversary. Well, I think it was from the 10th anniversary of AA in Cleveland. That's Dr. Bob on his feet. And to his right is Lois in that little feather hat. And to her right, or our right, I guess, and her right, is Bill. And the man to Dr. Bob's left is Bill D. And you see, to protect their anonymity, they all have their napkins up to their faces. It looks like a group sneeze. It was one of the pollen swept through the room. And here's the International Convention in 1950, 55 at St. Louis, where Bill and Bob turned over the fellowship to the members, you know, that they started a general service conference, which in 1955 had run its course 5 years. By the way, I'll show you a little demonstration of rigorous honesty. When the press took these pictures, these seats weren't filled. You know, like here, they just probably had their big books in front of them and nobody at the seats. But all these little heads were drawn in. They're like little Martian heads, you know, and to fill in the seats so it didn't look like the thing was empty. And here's 1960. It was in Long Beach, and I understand it was freezing. They were freezing. 4th of July in Long Beach is usually hot, but this year it was freezing. People had newspapers in their suits, and Bill spoke over 2 hours. So people were dead and dying, and but I guess happy and sober. And here's Toronto, 1965. That's where I Am Responsible pledge. They're on the stage. And in that film strip, Markings on a Journey, you get their voices in unison saying the I Am Responsible pledge. It's very powerful. They didn't have to draw on heads there. And this is Miami. You remember that Wesley spoke at this one. He filled in for Bill. Bill was dying of emphysema in a hospital nearby. And could not speak for one of his commitments, and Wesley, who I think was chairman of that event, took over for Bill. And then Bill very dramatically was able to appear at the closing ceremony on Sunday, and they brought him in with an oxygen mask and on a wheelchair, of course, and he just struggled to his feet and gave an incredible address for about 6 or 7 minutes. And people who have been there, sadly, I wasn't able to be there, but people have never forgotten that moment. Very powerful. And here's Denver, 1975. They had a two-story coffee pot. You know, it made coffee. Any place in this auditorium, they had spigots, and you could pull on and get your cup of coffee. They never had it again. I was mesmerized when somebody told me about that thing. I thought it was wonderful. They said the coffee, unfortunately, tasted like camel urine, but it was a wonderful delivery system, you know. And here is New Orleans, 1980, hotter than hell in New Orleans on the 4th of July weekend, but about, I believe, as I remember, 19,000 people were there, and they had some guy who, we had yellow badges that year, somebody said, "What are all those yellow badges?" And they said, "Come along with us." And that guy stayed sober the whole 4 days, and he was a homeless person, so they brought him back to California, and he just stayed in the AA community getting sober. He drank again, but now he's back, I understand. So someday we'll all hear his story. And here's Montreal, 1985. People on their feet doing the waves, you know, that kind of thing. It was wonderful. A moment of silence, like when Stu opens the meeting, you feel the power when we're all silent. Well, when you have 40,000 people having a long moment of silence, it's thunderous. You can hear the blood in your head. And it's just an incredible experience. So I hope you're all able to go to Denver in next year. San Diego, sorry. And this is Bernard Smith. He helped Bill design the general service structure. And in AA Comes of Age, there's an address by Smith. I'll read just some excerpts from it. But he was a very powerful force, a non-alcoholic, chairman of the board, a very powerful, although he looks like an alky, doesn't he? Yeah. Looks like he had a bad night. And but anyway, he was a brilliant man and a lawyer and a big component to structuring the program where the groups really run Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, setting up the general service structure. Here's Bill addressing the third general service conference at the Hotel Roosevelt. And we met for 18 years in the Hotel Roosevelt. And that's the end of it. Good. Here are three non-alcoholic chairmen of the board. That's Dr. Jack Norris. He was the chairman of the board for 17 years. And Gordon Patrick, a Canadian, in the center. And Milton Maxwell. Milton Maxwell did the analysis of the Washingtonians and Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you ever get a chance to read it, it makes you very humble. You remember we shared that experience that at one time the Washingtonians had a population, recovered sots, of about 400,000 when the population of the country was 20 million. And in 8 to 12 years, they had vanished. You know, AA would have to have 10 million in the United States alone to have the same ratio. So it makes you wonder, and you realize that this thing is fragile, and we have to be careful. Just like my own sobriety is fragile, I can't do anything. I have to be careful and follow principles. And we have to do that collectively as well. And here's a nice letter from John D. Rockefeller. Bill had sent Rockefeller, I think, the second printing of the big book, and he writes this wonderful letter. In December a year ago, you very kindly sent me a copy of Alcoholics Anonymous with a beautiful inscription on the flyleaf. To my consternation and chagrin, I now find I have never written you to express my appreciation of this generous, gracious gesture on your part. Please forgive the oversight and accept at this late date the assurance of my cordial thanks for both the book and the inscription. It must give you the greatest satisfaction to know that the friendly hand which you held out to a needy brother some years ago has resulted in such widespread extension of that helpful act. The regenerating power of the spirit in which that friendly hand was extended has been the means of saving countless valuable lives that would otherwise have been wrecked. May God continue to bless you in your work and use you increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. With every good wish for a happy new year, I am very sincerely John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Yeah, January 3rd. We received it January 3rd. He wrote it December 30th, 1946. And here's a non-alcoholic member who was very helpful in getting, I'm trying to think of his, Austin McCormick. Right. Thank you, John. Very helpful in getting AA established in penal institutions. He was a penologist, a very respected one, and a big supporter of AA. And as you know, AA is virtually in every prison today. I've forgotten, we have something like 55,000 members in prisons today. John? Here's Bill and Bob. One of the few pictures, I think we only have three or four pictures that they're able to be in together. You'll notice their neckties match the curtain. Those neckties are back in style now. So if you get your hands on one, hold on to it. And here's the Bill Wilson house in Clinton Street in Brooklyn. It's still a private home. And we saw a rendering of it before where Bill lost it. Bill and Lois lost it during the Depression. And here's Bill, and that's Lois cut off the little head there. She's at a piano. He was a lot taller than she was, even standing, even when she stood. But now she's seated at a piano. And he taught himself how to play that violin. It was a gift from some AA members, and he taught himself how to play it. And they had musical moments up at Stepping Stones. One of the Oxford Group books, it's a very powerful expression of what the movement was about. John? Here's that's Frank Bookman on the left, and Konrad Adenauer. The Oxford groups virtually disappeared at the beginning of World War II, but it reemerged as moral rearmament, MRA, post-war. And Bookman himself was credited with the early and friendly reconciliation of France and Germany, that they were able to work together for the reconstruction of Europe and to move into the community that is Western Europe today. And part of it was the fact that he had the same methods that we have for reconciliation, and it worked. France and Germany were able to negotiate a peace and are living in peace today. Oh, thank you.